It is the Saturday Coffee Clutch with Heather Lofthouse and yours truly, Robert Reich. We thought we would do something a little bit different today than we normally do, and that is to take a deeper dive into why we are where we are as a nation today. Why do 40% of Americans, or maybe more, find a dictator, a sort of proto-fascist, somebody who they actually would consider voting for? Why are we so split as a nation? Where did this all come from? And Heather, I thought that this would be something that would be interesting.
I know, and I'm looking forward to it. And the first thing that comes to mind is you.
Me?
Being psychic in 1994, I mean, you predicted this. You said things, this is what is going to happen. Have you all seen it? Let's take a look.
My friends, we are on the way to becoming a two-tiered society, composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind, whose anger and whose disillusionment is easily manipulated. Once unbottled, mass resentment can poison the very fabric of society, the moral integrity of a society, replacing ambition with envy, replacing tolerance with hate. Today, the targets of that rage, and we see it around us. You can only read the daily paper. You don't have far to look. Today, the targets of that rage are immigrants and welfare mothers and government officials and gays and an ill-defined counterculture. But as the middle class continues to erode, who will be the targets tomorrow?
Well, that is a little bit sobering.
It's
sobering because I was looking so much younger.
Oh, that.
And I was pretty good looking at that time. I'm now.
Bob, come on. You are.
Gray.
Not.
But
true.
I did understand one thing, and that was that widening inequality at the rate we were going then, even then, was dangerous for our society.
But you pictured it at this level. I mean, it wasn't just inequality is a problem, everybody. We really need to fix it. It was like, look, I am looking into the future. I am seeing the trends. And no one heeded what you said.
Nobody heeded it. But I think, Heather, it was not that difficult because history is full of instances. I mean, look at what happened in Germany in the 1930s and in Italy. And when people are feel like the game is rigged against them and they feel like they've nothing really to lose and they're angry and frustrated and anxious, they will be fodder, exploited by a demagogue.
I know.
Eventually. And this is exactly what's happened. But the point that I think I was making there, and certainly looking back would make, is that Donald Trump is the consequence, not the cause, of many of these deep problems that America has.
Yes. And you've said that before. And so, give us specifics. Can you give us what exactly, if you had to pick, I don't know, three things, four things, two things?
Well, the basic problem is that for 40 years,
right,
you have a large number of Americans, the typical American's wage adjusted for inflation, has not gone anywhere.
I know.
In terms of real purchasing power. And this is so violative of the American dream because, you know, in the 1930s, we were in a depression and then we had a war. But post-war America, certainly between 1946 and 1978, 79, was a land in which the middle class kept growing. And everybody expected, justifiably expected, that they would do better in their own lifetimes, and their children would do better than they did.
Right.
And then starting in the late 70s, really starting with Ronald Reagan's administration, everything reversed itself. And instead of everybody doing better, the middle class started shrinking, and people found that they were doing worse.
But the narrative didn't change, right? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
The narrative didn't change. That's right.
And that is...
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, the American dream was still something that people felt that they were, they aspired to.
Yeah.
And they avoided facing the reality. I mean, large numbers of middle-class women went into paid work in the late 70s. Now, we say it's because all of these wonderful opportunities opened for women, but actually, if you look at the data, what you see is that women went into paid work because they had to maintain the standard of living of their families because male wages were going down.
Right.
Why were male wages going down? In part because the country was losing good unionized manufacturing jobs.
Right.
Why were we losing good unionized manufacturing jobs? Because the structure of the economy shifted when the people who are now called private equity and hedge fund managers, but were then corporate raiders, they took over corporations or threatened to take over corporations that did not maximize share values.
Yep.
So up until that time, and that's roughly the late 70s, you had corporations that believed in, and their heads of the corporations believed in, stakeholder capitalism.
You did a great article, I'm plugging it for you, on the New York in the New York Times about Sears. I remember that.
Well,
about exactly this.
Sears Roebuck was a good example. Sears Roebuck, for all its years, had an employee profit-sharing plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you were a Sears employee by the 1950s, you had, and you had started at Sears even in the 20s, you had accumulated a huge amount of money. I mean, you could retire not only with a pension, but you could retire with a big chunk of Sears Roebuck.
Mm-hmm.
You were one of the owners. But all of that changed dramatically. The only people who became owners were the private equity people.
Yep.
And the, the vulture capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual structure of the economy, because of globalization, because of the pressures on these companies to maximize shareholder returns, because of the attempt to bust unions, which really was successful. Heather, in the 1950s and 60s, when I grew up, 35% of all of the workers in the private sector were in unions.
I know.
By now, it's 6%.
Yeah, one
35%
out of 3.
Yeah. Down to 6%.
It's nothing.
Well, you have no bargaining leverage.
So there's we'll talk about that. So countervailing power, gone. But it's so, I mean, even last week or whenever it was, a whole bunch of Republican governors wrote a letter that said, unions are really, let's not, as it related to the VW plant and who was it, Mercedes in the South. I mean, a lot of people do not want unions gone. But we are seeing that there are some efforts that are peaking, right?
Well, the interesting thing about where we are right now is that unions have become more popular than they've been in 30 years. And there are more employees who say, we want to join a union.
That's it.
But we can't.
Right. So the numbers haven't caught up to the interest.
No, because the anti-union sentiment is still there. I mean, big companies are anti-union. Look at Tesla, for example.
Yes.
I mean, the same week that Elon Musk has the Tesla shareholders vote on whether he's going to get a $47 billion package, pay package, $47 billion.
Billion.
I mean, it's the same week he lays off 14,000 Tesla workers. Now, these mass layoffs were something that did not occur. They occurred during the Depression because companies had no choice.
Right.
But for profitable companies to lay off workers in large numbers.
With 2 months severance.
And 2 months severance.
For the Tesla workers,
I mean, workers who have been laid off. I know a lot of people who have been laid off for periods of time. It is not pleasant.
Of course
it is a horrible experience. To lay off 14,000 workers Instead of treating workers as assets to be developed, what you have modern CEOs are treating workers as costs to be cut. Mm-hmm. And these are the same CEOs who are making $20, $30, $40 million a year.
Yep.
And that's not even to mention Tesla and
right.
the $47 billion pay package.
That's it. Okay, so decline in unions. You talked a little bit about globalization. More on that?
Well, I think that by the 1990s, and I was part of an administration that wanted NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Act, and wanted China to join the World Trade Organization, I think it was conventional wisdom that trade was inevitable. Bill Clinton used to give speeches about, you know, you can't stop trade. It's you can't stop globalization. And there was a memory of the Smoot-Hawley Act during the 1930s, isolationist act, tried to preserve jobs, which backfired.
Yeah.
Because less trade meant less commerce, and it meant fewer jobs.
Yeah.
But it became a kind of a touchstone by the 90s, without any thinking about it, that trade was good.
Yeah.
And the lack of thinking, and I was labor secretary, the lack of thinking had to do with what happens to the people who lose jobs because of trade. Do we have a plan? Do we have a system in place for making them whole again, for getting them good jobs, for tiding their families over while they are looking for good jobs? We didn't have anything.
Nope.
And then came the financial crisis of 2008. And Heather, where were you during the financial crisis?
During the Great Recession? So I landed a job, so I'm very fortunate. I had very low rent, and I had just gotten my master's degrees from UC Berkeley, and I was working in global health. So I basically avoided the recession in that I spent a lot of time on the ground in Africa and Asia, and I had this job. And so many of my family and friends were affected by it far greater than I was. I happened to be able to band-aid it in this way.
I think the Great Recession was a trauma for the country.
And for people like me. So I was in, how old was I? 30-ish. Is that right? That's right.
No,
yeah.
You were 15.
No, I'm serious. I was 30. I was born in 77. It was devastating. And it was in a way, as a 30-year-old to process that, it's different than you're when a kid. And so for sure, a lot of my cohort and my friends and my colleagues, I mean, it was like, wow, this was the first time they really felt it being on their own.
Well, see, this is a tripartite problem. Number one, you have globalization without mm-hmm. any effort to help people cope with loss of jobs from
yep.
globalization. Number two, you have the demise of unions
yep.
Because companies are trying to maximize shareholder returns. And number three, you have the financialization of the economy, deregulation of Wall Street, which led to the financial crisis.
Yep.
Many Americans before the financial crisis, I talked about coping mechanisms mm-hmm. as women went into the mm-hmm. paid workforce. Another coping mechanism was to use your homes as piggy banks.
Yep.
Basically get bank loans using
yep.
the house as collateral.
Line of credit, yep.
Or a second mortgage. After the Great Recession, after the explosion of the housing market in 2008, that was no longer possible.
Yeah.
And so what we had in this country after the financial crisis of 2008 and the bank bailout
yep.
was the emergence of the Occupy movement and also at the same time another movement on the right, which was
the Tea Party movement.
Movement.
I got it. But can we just say we're using the past tense now, and we are talking about the past, but there are lingering effects from that, the Great Recession, that are still...
Oh, absolutely.
Right. So, I mean, of course.
Absolutely.
But.
In fact, if you are a young person today, and I know this because even young college students, they have student debt, but they can't get into the housing market.
Right.
We stopped building housing. They can't even expect to start their families because they don't have enough money.
But private equity is doing just fine.
Private equity is doing fine.
It's got a lot of housing to choose from.
The structural problems that started in the late 70s, early 80s are still with us.
Yep.
And that's my point, Heather, yeah. because you've got a large number of people in this country who are anxious, who are frustrated, upset, who feel like the game is rigged against them, and it is rigged against them. Yeah. And so they naturally, now I'm not justifying, I'm explaining, there's a difference. Mm-hmm. They are attracted to a demagogue who promises to make America great again.
You have told me a great story before about being on the ground. You were doing one of your documentaries and they dragged you somewhere and you were interviewing workers on the ground, basically about where they were. Tell this story for people who haven't heard
it. Well, it was 2015 at a time when Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, do you remember Jeb Bush?
Yes.
Were both the assumed heads of their parties in terms of the nominations for president in 2016. And I was going around doing kind of a free-floating focus group for research and also for a film I was doing, and talking to many of the union people that I knew from 20 years before and their children. But it was all, it was the industrial Midwest, the Rust Belt, the South, farmers in Missouri. And I would ask them who they thought were the best prospects and the people that they were attracted to for president the next year. Was it Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton? And they kept on saying to me, and I couldn't believe it, we are very interested in two people, and the same person would say this, either Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. And I'd say, no, that can't possibly be. Right. They're on opposite ends of the continuum.
Right.
But you, no, they liked Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump because they weren't politicians, they were not traditional establishment figures, and they were talking authentically about real stuff. And
they felt heard by them both.
And they felt that they were, both of them, reflecting the conversations that these people, average Americans, in the Rust Belt, in the South, in the Midwest, were having about over the kitchen table.
Yep.
Now, Heather, it is very important to understand that American populism, which is basically a rejection of elites and the establishment, American populism is the most important force in American politics today. Joe Biden is the perfect president because he is so much of a populist himself, if he let his populist side be shown. I mean, he's a labor guy. He's from Scranton, Pennsylvania, my hometown. He's a just an average, good American, and he gets it. He gets it. When he walks a picket line, he understands what those workers are doing and why they're on a picket line.
But he feels like less of a messiah to these people, right? Well, 40% you keep talking about. I mean, what are they seeing in Donald Trump that they're not seeing in the guy that cares about labor?
Messiah is the word you used, and that's an important word. Because what a lot of people who have been just feel like they've been treated so badly by employers, by the economy, by the elites, by the establishment for so many years, what they see in Donald Trump is almost a religious figure, a messiah, somebody who's going to deliver them
Savior.
From where they have been. And he is obviously a complete fraud.
I know.
And a scumbag. But he plays that role. Bernie Sanders could have and did for a while.
Of course. Now, I think once, so you as Secretary of Labor, you really thought about workers, how everything was changing, how do we change things on the home front? I think that the Biden administration, Biden and the Inflation Reduction Act is trying to do something similar as it creates these labor standards with all the stuff that comes out of the IRA. And with these, you know, green jobs and that kind of thing, I think unions hopefully will be on an upswing as it relates to that and tethered to those requirements. What do you think about that? Is that, I mean,
I think you're 100% correct. This is the side of Joe Biden's administration that is not being talked about. It's very difficult for people to believe it. There's such cynicism, which is another legacy of what we're talking about. But Biden has done several things to reverse the currents, the trends that got us into this predicament.
Right.
Strengthening unions. I mean, his National Labor Relations Board is one of the most pro-union and activist I remember. Going after corporate monopolies.
Hello, yeah.
His antitrust division of the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission are the most activist trust busters, big corporate monopoly.
And we're talking about big tech, and we're talking about grocery companies, corporations,
and this is very important, and it's very interesting and important at the same time. He's going after, he is the first Democratic administration not to load his economic team with people from Wall Street.
Yeah.
In fact, he doesn't have Wall Streeters. This is below the radar. But Heather, it's important because it means that the economic advice he's getting is not infected by the financialization of the economy.
Yeah. I know. Okay, so it's been, what'd you say, 40 years, 50 years? You've been watching
70,
all this?
70, 80.
You've been watching all this happen?
Yes, yes.
So what else can we do? I mean, the Biden administration is doing that. So there's this, and Trump has just ridden this wave. I mean, he is playing it beautifully.
Well, I think that if there is a second Biden administration, please,
when,
God.
Let's use when.
I think he will move into the areas that need attention. Child care, elder care, housing, availability, and also getting big money out of politics.
Yes.
This is the agenda.
Yep.
And the Democrats have got to become economic populists to the extent that this is an economic populist agenda.
And they think they are, don't they?
Well, they think they are, but actually, when it comes to standing up to Wall Street and to big corporations, Joe Biden is willing to do it.
Yeah.
But many Democrats, frankly, that's where their money, campaign money, comes from.
Of course.
So they're still reluctant.
And we've talked about this ad nauseum, but the messaging around it needs to improve, right?
Well, it does need to improve. But what does that mean? What it means is that Democrats have to be willing to name names, to blame certain corporations, to not vilify, but to explain to the public why we are at where we are, which has a lot to do with power and the accumulation of wealth and power at the top, not just in terms of individuals, but also big corporations. And that is a populist economic message, which is true. It has the virtue of being true. And it is important that the public understand this.
One thing you said the other day to me, I think it was even over coffee, we just didn't, wasn't this coffee. You said, we talked about the labor beat. So journalists used to follow labor and there were stories, and that you don't see that anymore. And that is also a problem, or a symptom, or both.
Well, it's a symptom and it's a problem both. That is, the labor reporters, Steve Greenhouse is a good example for the New York Times. Steve used to put on the front page of the New York Times stories about what organized labor was doing, what they were trying to do, why it was important, what their goals were. And so people understood organized labor as a vital and important political force. But as union busting took over in the, really in the 90s and at the beginning part of this century, these big media organizations got rid of their labor reporters. They didn't need them anymore. They felt, well, labor is an old story. If you go from 35% of the private sector workforce unionized down to, what, 6%, then why even talk about it? But you can see how that is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Well, so I don't want to keep you longer than you are able to stay.
No, I'm loving this, Clutch. Are you kidding me? It's so great. It's
but
it's a different level. It's so.
Well,
it's,
I don't, also don't want to just be didactic and professorial.
No, we want that. We want that, don't we? I do.
Well,
they do.
Okay.
No.
Well, but there's a lot more to say about all of this. But I think that if there is one lesson here, it's that the Inflation Reduction Act and Joe Biden and the direction he's going in are extremely important. People don't know it. It's very hard to get it across. But the historic context that I've provided is something that may be helpful. Hope it is helpful to all of you. And thanks for being with us. Please join us again next Saturday.